And again, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, about a 50% chance of showers, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Coming up at 9 o'clock today, a special for you, an episode of Ham Radio, Cooking with Amy Phelan, today all about the abundance of our gardens. More news is next on KAXE.
Good morning. Europeans have plans to send troops to Ukraine if there ever is a peace deal with Russia. We'll talk with Poland's foreign minister about the possibilities in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. One count says Israel killed 220 journalists in Gaza in less than 2 years. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Today, news outlets around the world, including us at NPR, are demanding that Palestinian journalists in Gaza be protected. Also, sports writer Jane Levy says Major League Baseball looks so closely at data, it's not focusing on how to entertain fans. It's Monday, September 1st. On this day in 1964, 20-year-old lefty pitcher Masanori Murakami became the first Japanese MLB player debuting for the San Francisco Giants. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Hundreds of news outlets around the world have signed on to an appeal calling for the protection of Palestinian journalists in Gaza and for foreign press to be granted independent access to the territory. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports more than 200 Palestinian journalists have been killed by Israeli forces since the war broke out.
Many of the media outlets signed on are blacking out their front pages or, like NPR, are taking part by reporting on the appeal and the risks Palestinian journalists face in Gaza. A similar petition signed in June by the editors-in-chiefs of major news organizations noted that Israel's ban on independent access to Gaza is without precedent in modern warfare. Moreover, the Committee to Protect Journalists says August was the deadliest month ever recorded for journalists globally. That's due to what Palestinians say is 15 journalists killed in Gaza in August alone. Last week, Israeli attacks killed 5 journalists at a hospital, including photographers for Reuters and the AP. 2 more journalists were killed since then in other attacks. Aya Betraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
Israel's foreign ministry says the appeal shows the media's, quote, bias against Israel. China is hosting more than 24 world leaders at 2 major defense-related events this week. The summit underscores how President Trump's tariffs are driving a strategic shift toward regional alliances and away from U.S.-led economic influence. NPR's Dia Hadid reports.
The context appears to be Trump's remaking of foreign policy, which has felt pretty unpredictable for much of the world, like tariffs on friends, European Union and India, initial hostility to Ukraine, now peace talks. So since 2001, China's sought to align Asian nations and former Soviet countries, in part through this grouping called the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It's happened in fits and starts, though, but this summit appears to be the most important. It's certainly the largest.
That's NPR's Dia Hadid reporting. Labor unions are protesting the Trump administration's stop work order on a major wind farm project. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports the project off the coast of Rhode Island is nearly complete.
The Trump administration abruptly halted work on the Revolution Wind Project on August 22nd. Brent Booker, general president of the Laborers International Union of North America, says 2 million hours of work have already been completed.
Not only does that affect the individuals who are working on that, but an entire industry now is, you know, what's going to happen? Who's going to invest right now in renewable energy? And that just takes away future jobs.
Interior Secretary Doug Burgum told CNN there are concerns of undersea drone attacks and that the project did not receive a full review under former President Biden. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
Wall Street is closed for the Labor Day holiday. Trading resumes on the exchange tomorrow. Stocks across Asia closed mixed today. This is NPR News in Washington. Hollywood summer box office numbers will end up roughly even with last year. NPR's Bob Mondello reports for film studios that counts as both a relief and a letdown.
$3.6 billion is what the film industry expects this summer's movies to have taken in by the end of the holiday weekend. Nothing to sneeze at, certainly, but given ever-increasing ticket prices, not really something to cheer.
We have a blue dog to catch.
Lilo and Stitch, Superman, Jurassic World Rebirth, and 8 other films this summer qualified as blockbusters, meaning they've each taken in more than $100 million.
The largest dinosaurs on the planet.
But there's less strength with smaller movies as audiences wait to stream films without superheroes, aliens, or dinosaurs. Back before the pandemic, the summer of 2019 had the same number of blockbusters, but that summer's lesser films were stronger, so the industry took in about $500 million more overall. Bob Mondello, NPR News.
Those tiny, fish-shaped soy sauce bottles are a staple in takeout sushi, but not anymore in South Australia. Starting this week, restaurants there will be banned from handing them out as part of a broader push to reduce plastic waste. The state was the first in Australia to ban the bottles and has steadily expanded its list of prohibited plastics, making it the strictest in the country. The Powerball jackpot has skyrocketed to an estimated $1.1 billion after there was no winner in Saturday's drawing. Tonight's drawing will be the fifth largest prize in the game's history. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at Cigna.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Everything started to fall into place, and I kind of felt like I was breathing for the first time in 27 years.
This is Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served, a series exploring the challenges Minnesota's veterans face, as well as the opportunities and services available to them.
My name is Mike McLaughlin, United States Air Force. I served from 2002 to 2005. It was the best decision in my adult life to get the PTSD treatment. I'd been treated for mental health my whole life. I had a lot of trauma growing up. I had a lot of trauma in the military, many different therapies, many different counseling sessions. You start spinning out of control, and they call it catch it, check it, and change it. Cognitive behavioral therapy. It's gotten to that point where I'm catching that I'm spinning, I'm checking it, and now I'm changing it. It doesn't get easier, it gets different. My anger is no longer out of control. I'm a better dad, I'm a better husband, I'm now remarried, and I'm a better person.
Beyond Active Duty, Caring for Those Who Served is produced by AMPERS with support from the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, providing our veterans with help. Veterans can find that help online at MinnesotaVeteran.org.
Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Poland's foreign minister joins this program to discuss the war in neighboring Ukraine.
First, though, the Associated Press is reporting this morning that Russia is suspected of having jammed the radar of a plane carrying the European Commission's top leader. The news comes as European leaders are drafting plans to send a coalition of troops to Ukraine as part of a possible post-war security guarantee. The effort comes when there's no Russia-Ukraine peace process, much less a peace deal. Still, European leaders are working to come up with ways to help secure Ukraine if and when a deal is struck.
Terry Schultz has been tracking the meetings and joins us from Brussels. Hi there, Terry.
Good morning, Steve.
What's the plan?
Well, this is something European countries have been working on for many months in what they call the Coalition of the Willing. It's spearheaded by France and the UK. And the latest headlines claiming plans are, quote, pretty precise, come from an interview with European Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen, who's currently traveling through the EU countries on the bloc's eastern flank. Here's what she said about security guarantees for Ukraine when she was in Poland on Sunday.
The first line of defense in Ukraine is a strong Ukrainian army. The second line of defense is a multinational group, the Coalition of the Willing, with the backstop of the Americans. And then the third and most important line of defense is, of course, our own defense posture.
So these coalition plans do involve sending European troops into Ukraine after a peace agreement is reached and with significant logistical assistance from the U.S., which President Trump assured them he'd provide. But all of this planning is very hypothetical.
Does this coalition have enough troops available, given that the United States would not participate?
Certainly not yet. It's very difficult for leaders to commit their armed forces, as you can imagine, to a dangerous mission that is still so undefined. They've got no idea of where a ceasefire line might be, what the troops would be used for, and again, what kind of U.S. contribution would be there to deter the Russians from attacking. But some countries have made clear they're less unwilling than others, and Estonia is among them. Here's Defense Minister Hanno Pevkur.
We are ready to contribute immediately after the ceasefire, and then we have to see how the other allies will continue. We say that the company size unit is something we are considering and we are ready to deploy. The U.S. has to be, of course, together with us. This is, I believe, clear for everyone.
French President Emmanuel Macron has called a meeting of the coalition in Paris on Thursday, and the U.S. doesn't usually participate in those talks.
What the U.S. has done, of course, is speak directly with the Russians and with President Putin. President Trump has set a number of deadlines. He has then let the deadlines slide, and now Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is suggesting that today should be a deadline for the Russians to get serious or face a tougher response. Do the Europeans have a response?
Well, this would, as you say, really be a deadline for President Trump to set, given that he's leading the efforts to bring the two sides in. And Ukraine has agreed to the talks. So European leaders are calling on Trump to put a price on Putin simply continuing to fight. And by the way, Steve, the European Union's own diplomatic mission in Kyiv was severely damaged in a Russian airstrike last week. So they're focused on what they can do, pushing through a 19th package of sanctions on Moscow and threatening to give some 200 billion euros worth of frozen Russian assets to Ukraine, instead of just using the interest on those accounts, as is the case now, to pay for reconstruction. But it's really the White House that has the stick here. And European partners would very much like to see President Trump use it.
Terry Schultz is in Brussels. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
We're going to take a closer look now at Europe's posture toward Ukraine and Russia with Polish Foreign Minister Radoslaw Sikorski. He also serves as Deputy Prime Minister. Good morning and welcome to the back to the program.
Hello, good morning.
So we just heard news this morning of a suspected Russian operation jamming the radar of a plane carrying European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Does this mark an escalation by Russia toward Europe?
Well, I don't want to speculate on the nature of the attack, but we've had Russian arson, Russian assassinations, Russian espionage, and yes, the jamming of the GPS signal all over Europe. Our ships in the area of the Bay of Gdańsk are regularly affected by this Russian method.
Now, we heard our correspondent there reporting about this, quote, precise plan for potential military deployments from Europe to Ukraine in a post-war security guarantee. Will Polish troops be part of this coalition, be deploying?
Well, we have a large army, over 200,000, and we did provide a brigade for Iraq, where we were in charge of an international division, and a brigade in Afghanistan. But this is different. We are already managing a huge logistical operation. 95% of what Ukraine gets goes through Poland. And so this time we see our usefulness as protecting that operation on our own territory.
Now, Poland neighbors Ukraine, as you point out, so this threat to Europe beyond Ukraine's border is very tangible for your country. What do you want to see from the U.S. when it comes to pressuring Russia for a peace deal?
Well, let's first say that when you say tangible, it really is. You know, we have Russian drones and Russian cruise missiles regularly breaching our airspace. So one of those Russian missiles landed 10 kilometers from my house, which is in Western Poland. Yes, it's good to plan for a peacekeeping operation after there is either a ceasefire or a peace deal, but I don't yet see any indications that Putin is willing to stop the war.
Yeah.
He thinks he's winning. I think he's misinformed, but this colonial war will only stop when Putin concludes that he can't achieve his objectives at an acceptable cost, and he's not there yet.
And what will it take for him to get there? I mean, you mentioned this is a post-war plan, but there's no clear plan for peace. We watched President Trump work to get Russia to the negotiating table, only for Russia to wage one of its biggest attacks on Ukraine after Putin and Trump's meeting in Alaska.
Indeed, Putin seems to be mocking the peace efforts of President Trump. But Ukraine has defeated Russia at sea. It is successfully targeting Russian oil refineries. There are shortages of petrol in Russia now. On land, it is imposing huge costs on every kilometer of land that Russia grabs from Ukraine. This is not a sustainable strategy for Putin.
So are you saying the only way for Putin to come to the table in a real way is if he feels there will be a military defeat?
If he fears that his economy might not survive this war. And so for that to happen, we need to do what President Trump has suggested, namely allow Ukraine to more deep strike on military targets, such as refineries, and of course, impose tougher sanctions on Russia.
We've heard the U.S. say there needs to be land swaps for peace. Do you agree with that assessment, that Ukraine needs to give up some of its land for this war to stop?
I don't think we should be in the business of suggesting to Ukraine what sacrifices it is willing to make on behalf of peace. That should be a subject for direct conversations between Ukrainians and Russians.
The U.S. effort, President Trump's effort, to come to a peace deal, these peace talks, without a ceasefire first. Has this been a successful strategy?
Well, there is, you know, the normal way to do it would be to have a secret negotiation in some third country through intermediaries and to see if both countries' red lines might cross at any point. I don't think they do yet.
Polish Foreign Minister Radosław Sikorski, thank you for your time and your insights.
Thank you.
In this country, President Trump says Chicago needs to do more to address crime and enforce immigration laws, which is why he's talking about surging federal agents there, even U.S. troops. NPR's Joe Hernandez reports on what local officials are saying.
Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson says the city still doesn't know exactly what the Trump administration is planning, but he says he doesn't want the federal government to use the Chicago police to do it. That's why on Saturday, Johnson signed an executive order prohibiting the Chicago Police Department from collaborating with federal agents on civil immigration enforcement operations.
This executive order makes it emphatically clear that this president is not going to come in and deputize our police department.
The order also requires Chicago police officers to wear their uniforms and not wear masks so they can be distinguished from federal agents. Still, the Trump administration appears to be moving ahead with a plan to intensify immigration enforcement in Chicago. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem told CBS's Face the Nation on Sunday that ICE is already operating in the city, but more needs to be done.
But we will continue to go after the worst of the worst across the country, like President Trump has told us to do.
Last week, when discussing the ramping up of enforcement efforts, White House border czar Tom Homan said the government would focus on cities like Chicago, New York, and Los Angeles.
All these sanctuary cities that refuse to work with ICE, where we know public safety threats are being released every day into this country, especially those cities, we're going to address that.
Suggestions of an immigration crackdown in Chicago come several weeks after the Trump administration deployed the National Guard to Washington, D.C. to fight crime. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker told Face the Nation that if the government sends troops into Chicago, it would be akin to an invasion. Local law enforcement agencies already work with federal agencies like the FBI and DEA, but Pritzker says this would be different.
I'm saying we don't want troops on the streets of American cities. Right. That's un-American. And frankly, the president of the United States ought to know better.
Pritzker says the Trump administration should work with state and local officials rather than send in federal forces against their wishes. Joe Hernandez, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. Thank you for listening to the Monday Morning Show on this Labor Day. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with exhibits, classes, and handcrafted original art made by regional artists found in their shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public, watermarkartcenter.org. Weather for today, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 70s, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms, mostly cloudy tonight with lows in the upper 50s, and again, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. For tomorrow, about a 50% chance of showers, partly sunny, highs in the upper 60s to low 70s. Itasca County Habitat for Humanity offers a Financial Foundations course beginning next Monday, September 8th. The class meets once a month through January and helps build knowledge so you can make informed financial decisions and achieve long-term goals. Call Itasca County Habitat to register. And coming up this Saturday, September 6th, it is Grand Rapids River Fest. We encourage you to get your tickets now. We welcome Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Find your tickets and all the information you need at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. Coming up just after 6:30, we'll hear Minnesota Native News. And after 7 o'clock, it's a special edition of the Up North Report. Right now, we continue with Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Progressive Insurance, where drivers can compare direct rates using Progressive's rate comparison tool. Customers can see options and rates side by side. More at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Layla Faldin.
And I'm Amy Martinez. Sports writer and reporter Jane Levy has written 5 books, all of them about baseball.
Sandy into his windup. Here's the pitch. Swung on and missed a perfect game.
There are biographies about Sandy Koufax, Mickey Mantle, and Babe Ruth, and a novel sort of based on her own career about a female beat writer for a big league baseball team. This lifelong love of the game has led to her latest work about what she doesn't love about it.
I went looking for another star of the magnitude of Koufax, Mantle, and Ruth, who I'd spent the better part of 20 years writing about. And I couldn't find a guy that fit that dimension. That troubled me. And I started to think, why is that? I think it has a lot to do with the way that analytics preclude a certain kind of stardom.
Jane Levy's new book is titled Make Me Commissioner, I Know What's Wrong with Baseball and How to Fix It. So, Jane, you usually write about people involved in baseball. What made you change course for this book?
The issue of how to entertain people has gotten lost. One of the examples I use is the story about Clayton Kershaw, who, of course, is the great Dodger lefty and has done pretty much everything there is to do in baseball except throw a perfect game. He had been on the injured list again for his arm. But lo and behold, his first start for the Dodgers in 2022 is in Minnesota.
Oh, my goodness. 7 perfect innings from Clayton Kershaw.
And he goes through 7 innings, and he's got a perfect game. And the decision is to pull him out of the game.
And Dave Roberts makes maybe the hardest decision of his managerial career here.
Dave Roberts and I talked about this at great length. It is clear that it pained him to do it. But what I said to him is, wouldn't it have been in baseball's interest to have a headline that said the next day, Clayton Kershaw, greatest lefty, throws a perfect game on his first outing of the year, as opposed to Clayton Kershaw was pulled out of a perfect game after 7 innings.
But Jane, analytics has been used in basketball. The Golden State Warriors are famous for starting their dynasty by relying on analytics, and it's all over every other sport. Why has that not worked as well, in your opinion, in baseball as it has in other sports?
Well, it works better in football because in football it tells you to go for it on fourth down, which is exciting. In baseball, it works against what makes baseball exciting.
it sounds like you're asking baseball to be perfect in their decision. Please fans, but also protect players. How is that possible?
Oh, it's not possible. I mean, maybe the best quote in the book is Joe Torre saying about analytics, they're asking an imperfect game to be perfect, and I resent that.
Now, recently, Jane, Major League Baseball made some pretty sweeping changes. I think the biggest shock was the pitch clock. How do you think that one's gone so far?
It's the best, and it's worked beautifully. It just took way too long for them to recognize that part of the problem was it's a 19th century game originated by guys who had pocket watches, and they didn't adjust to the world changing around them. But Theo Epstein, who came on board.
And he's the executive who led the Cubs and the Red Sox to their to World Series titles, yeah.
So in 2021, when he came on board, the average time between balls put in play was 3 minutes and 52 seconds. As Theo said to me, you have 12 minutes to sell the game to a six-year-old, and you're going to get two or maybe three balls in play in that time? That's impossible.
Every April 15th, Major League Baseball celebrates Jackie Robinson Day, and you write that the league claims, quote, a high moral ground to which it is no longer entitled. Why not?
Well, because the league allowed the percentage of black major leaguers to drop from a high point of nearly 20% to now 6%. The neglect of that population, which they have begun to address, and I give them props for that, not only changed what was available to kids, it changed the texture of the sport, because black players brought a different style of play that is sorely missing. The speed disappeared with the black players.
Now, the Savannah Bananas, it's baseball's answer to basketball's Harlem Globetrotters in many ways.
Oh, he lights the ball on fire!
If, Jane, you invented baseball today, would it look more like the MLB that we know, or would it be more like the Savannah Bananas?
Well, it would look more like baseball. I'm not in favor of having a whole pitching staff break into tap dance on the pitching mound. But I do think that Jesse Cole, the owner, the man in the yellow tux, zeroed in on something that baseball has been really laggardly about: their obligation to entertain the fans. I mean, I had an argument with Mike Rizzo, former Nats GM, about this. Why can't players on the injured list go into the stands and let kids sign their jerseys? But why can't somebody be required to stay the way Cal Ripken did after every home game in Baltimore and sign every autograph? There are things that they can do that are simple.
So, Jay, I mean, we've talked a lot about what maybe you're not happy with about baseball, but I want to know what you still love about baseball, because the thing I love the most about baseball is when the season starts, there's always another game tomorrow. So what do you still love the most about baseball?
I love the choreography of the game. I love seeing the way infielders used to turn a double play and the choreography around the bag when you could see their footwork. I love the craft of the game. I love the people. One of the things that was great about this book was the opportunity to go around and just meet so many wonderful baseball people who care about the technique, who care about the history, who accept that analytics is a part of the game, but are pleading for them to be used in a way that doesn't obviate what in the dugout is now called the human element.
That's Jane Levy. She might be on the next commissioner of baseball. Her new book is Make Me Commissioner. I Know What's Wrong with Baseball and How to Fix It. Jane, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was great.
This is NPR News.
Soul singer Kirby has toured with John Legend and Leon Bridges, written songs that have appeared on hit TV shows, and has more than a million TikTok followers. But she didn't build her career by saying yes to everything.
Sometimes it feels like I'm a slow cooker on the stove, honey, but the season and everything is going to be just right.
Kirby on her new album, Miss Black America, on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 6:29. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, Minnesota Native News. Support comes from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. We also thank Minnesota Power, an elite company envisioning a carbon-free future through their energy forward strategy. More at mmpower.com/energyforward.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock. This week, we're sharing a special extended conversation with a community member you've heard in earlier reports. Today, Travis Zimmerman's extended interview with Dr. Amber Annis of the Native Governance Center. Let's listen.
My name is Amber Annis. I am a citizen of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. I'm an Ekoju Lakota. I was born and raised in Eagle Butte, South Dakota, which is on the Cheyenne River Reservation. But I've lived here in St. Paul for the past 12 years now. And I have just stepped into the position of the executive director of the Native Governance Center.
Well, thank you. Native Governance Center. How long has the organization been around? What's its mission? Tell us more about that, please.
Native Governance Center, we have been around since 2015. At the time, we did have a physical space, so we did open our doors in 2015. And the Native Governance Center really emerged in response to a need that were being identified by tribal leaders, the 23 Native nations that share geography with Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota, but also beyond. And a need that we were hearing was having a structure or a system in place that was dedicated to assisting Native nations, Native citizens, and strengthening tribal governance sisters, but also our capacity to how to exercise sovereignty. We're a grassroots organization, and what we really do is serve those Native changemakers and elected tribal leaders.
Great. Well, thank you. What interested you in the position? What drew you to jump from what you're doing with the Historical Society into the executive director position at the Governance Center?
Well, you know, I have been familiar with Native Governance Center since its very beginning, since its inception, because it was a pretty unique concept, I would say, an organization solely dedicated to helping Native people and Native nations thrive within their own terms, looking very specifically at working with tribal leaders. So I've been familiar with it for a long time, and I am a part of the Code 11 Native Nation Rebuilders. That's one of our main programs out of Native Governance Center, the Native Nation Rebuilders, a leadership program. When I joined that program, I was really able to see the profound work that Native Governance Center was doing. I was able to spend 2 years with amazing folks, you know, across Indian country, learning from tribal elected leaders, some amazing Native elders, but also my cohort itself, you know, these amazing Native folks across Indian country that we all kind of came together with this same purpose, which was how am I as a Native citizen? How are we, wherever we may be, right, in our place in life, what are we doing? How are we standing with our nations where we're at? Whether that's you're living back home in your community, whether that is you're living in an urban area, how are we going back to our own traditional kind of forms of self-governance? But also at the same time, how are we doing that in a contemporary way?
What are some of your goals working with the Governance Center and working with the existing programs or maybe developing new programs?
In terms of vision and thinking about the future, Native Governance Center, we're at a really pivotal moment right now, I would say. We are at a moment where we are well-funded, well-supported, but we have to also think about what sustainability means for us. As a Native-led organization, a nonprofit, we really have to think, how are we sustaining ourselves in the future? So a hope and a goal of mine is to really try to think of how we can become a little bit more independent from those larger, amazing funds, right, that those donors and the funds that we have that we steward. How are we actually engaging, when we say engaging with Native nations, how are we looking to Native nations to really truly support and commit to the work that their own citizens, right? Our citizens of Native nations. How are we investing in our own people? And so I look forward to that. I look forward to those conversations. We are always looking for those folks that see the value in the work that we're doing and would like to be a part of our mission and would like to be a part of this larger network of change makers within Indian country.
Well, thanks a lot, Amber. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you so much, Travis. Pilame Aye, and Pilame Aye to all the listeners. And again, visiting nativegov.org.
That's all for this week. Join us next time for more voices and stories that inform, uplift, and shape our communities right here on Minnesota Native News. Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Reuters, the Associated Press, and Al Jazeera in strikes on a Gaza hospital last week. Israel's military said soldiers believed they were targeting a Hamas surveillance camera, but gave no evidence, and the prime minister has since called it a tragic mishap. Jonathan Dagger from Reporters Without Borders says Israeli forces have killed 220 journalists since the October 7th attacks. Is there a way that you define who is a journalist and who is not?
Anyone who does a journalistic activity following the ethics and the values of this job, anyone who does a job of transmitting information, but we're very clear on that they should be doing a job that is considered journalistic. For example, excluded from this list are people who would fall under freedom of expression, for example, poets or comedians or artists.
As you very well know, Israel will insist they're not deliberately targeting legitimate journalists, that people are in the way. In some cases, they've explicitly said, we targeted this person because we believe they are Hamas. What do you think Israel's doing here?
Well, you know, for at least 56 of these cases, we were able to collect testimonies, elements, images, evidence in some cases that show that there was actually targeting of journalists who were clearly identified as journalists. In some specific cases, the Israeli army has itself admitted to targeting them, giving the justification that, well, they were not really journalists, that they were also members of Hamas, that they were terrorists. We've also investigated these claims, and the very meager evidence that was provided by the Israeli army, these documents are often riddled by contradictions. Their media outlets confirm that they work with them. Anyone can go on their social media, on their pages, and see the work that they do. So the evidence and the justification given by the Israeli forces, we consider it defamatory, and it is certainly not a license to kill.
Does it appear to you that Hamas also pressures, threatens, or kills journalists?
We've received reports of threats and pressures by Hamas on journalists. Hamas never respected press freedoms. It was never democratic in that sense, obviously. And we denounced that. We have, according to our information, all of the journalists who were killed by Israeli strikes. The journalists on the ground, they tell us that is the primary danger.
What does it matter to the rest of the world if journalists are being killed at such a rate?
It's very dangerous. Every time a journalist is killed, it's an attack against our right to be informed everywhere in the world. Democracies are founded on public opinion and what it chooses, and public opinion is largely formed by information, and therefore a media blackout such as the one that Israel is imposing on Gaza is very dangerous for democracies everywhere in the world, not just for Gaza's journalists and for Gaza's population.
Jonathan Dagger of Reporters Without Borders, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
We're joined now by NPR's Daniel Estrin for more. He's in Tel Aviv. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning, Layla.
With all the dangers journalists in Gaza face today, what does it take for them to do their jobs?
You know, a typical day for a journalist in Gaza might be they'll go to the hospital morgue to count bodies and report how many people were killed in an Israeli strike. And then they'll go collect food and drinking water for their families. And then they'll rush to the scene of another Israeli airstrike, fearing that there might be an additional strike on that same spot that could injure or kill them. My NPR colleague, Ahmed Abu Hamda, spoke this weekend with a journalist in Gaza, Salam Ar-Rais. He reports for Arabic language news sites, and he said he spends his days covering his neighbors' daily struggles under war, and then those same people will turn around and tell him and his colleagues, don't get in my car, don't get in my cab wearing your press vest, don't park your car marked TV near me, because people in Gaza today are afraid journalists are a target and will endanger them.
Wow. I mean, we heard there from Reporters Without Borders the dangers of having an information blackout. A war of weapons is also an information war. And we heard there also that both sides are playing. But Israel's actually killing Palestinian journalists. How does the Israeli government defend that?
Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer last week summed up how Israel perceives Palestinian journalists in Gaza.
Many journalists who have reported from Gaza, so-called journalists, are simply terrorists with a press vest on.
When Israel admits to targeting journalists, it says it's doing so because they are alleged Hamas terrorists. Even when the evidence Israel presents is thin, most Israeli media report that as a fact. And so therefore, many Israelis view Palestinian journalists' deaths with indifference. When Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu expressed regret for the killing of AP and Reuters journalists last week, he only expressed it in English for an international audience. That regret was not issued in Hebrew to Israelis. I've spoken to independent Israeli analysts who believe Israel does not have a policy of deliberately targeting journalists in Gaza, but they also argue the military has repeatedly shown a disregard for the lives of journalists there. When the army identifies what they believe is yet another Hamas terrorist, they do not consider the bigger picture of, well, wait, there are journalists nearby who will be killed. This is according to the Israeli analysts I've spoken to. That the military does not consider the bigger picture of the global outrage that would come because of that.
NPR's Daniel Estrin talking to us from Tel Aviv. Thank you for your time, Daniel.
You're welcome, Leila.
In this country, a judge has blocked the United States from deporting as many as 600 Guatemalan children. Here's NPR's Kiara Eisner.
Minors who enter the U.S. unaccompanied are not allowed to be deported without first having the full opportunity to apply for legal status. But on Sunday, planes were loaded with Guatemalan children who had crossed the border alone.
We know that there were two planes in Harlingen, Texas, and one plane in El Paso, Texas. And that is from reports of people on the ground, physically at the airport, who saw these planes and the children being loaded onto the planes.
That's Efrain Olivares with the National Immigration Law Center, the U.S. firm defending some of the Guatemalan children. The children's lawyers scrambled to petition the U.S. government to stop them from being removed. And on Sunday morning, a federal judge temporarily halted the planes. The U.S. government argued Guatemala had asked for the children's return and said their parents had also requested their removal from the country. Attorneys for the children said their clients hadn't completed asylum proceedings. Here's a lawyer who was involved with the case, Becky Wallison. She's a senior attorney at the National Center for Youth Law.
They're clearly targeting children based exclusively on their national origin, which is also unlawful.
Then, Sunday evening, the Guatemalan government posted a statement to X. It was Guatemala that had suggested that the Guatemalan children should be sent to that country. No human rights had been violated, and all due process had been followed. Here's Kika Matos, president of the National Immigration Law Center.
This idea that on a long weekend, in the dead of night, they would wake up these vulnerable children and put them on a plane is something that should shock the conscience of all Americans.
NPR asked DHS and the Guatemalan government for comment. Neither responded. Kiara Eisner, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 6:42. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device, hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com, member FDIC. We also thank Itasca County Health and Human Services hosting the 17th annual Community Connect Thursday, September 18th from 11 to 3 at Yanmar Arena in Grand Rapids, featuring over 50 social service agencies providing info on housing, energy, county assistance, and more. All are welcome. Mostly sunny today with highs in the upper 70s. We do have a slight chance of showers or thunderstorms. Tonight, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 50s. Again, slight chance for showers and thunderstorms. Tomorrow, partly sunny, highs in the upper 50s to low 70s and a 50% chance of showers. The Bemidji Senior Center hosts a Medicare presentation this Wednesday at 1 o'clock. Learn about the plans available before open enrollment, which begins October 15th. And local author Anne-Marie Erickson celebrates the launch of her new book, In the Evening We'll Dance, a memoir in essays on love and dementia, this Thursday, 7 o'clock at the McCroskey Arts Center in Grand Rapids. Erickson will read brief excerpts of the book and sign copies. We continue now with Morning Edition on KAXE.
Some employers are ruling by fear of layoff. We'll hear about a better way, something called the psychological contract, next time, Here and Now.
Your city, your station, your news.
Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. Breaking news, this week the Music Television Channel will be playing Music Television. If you can remember the 80s or 90s, you know MTV used to be the go-to channel for music videos. Now it's mostly reality shows. But they're bringing back more than 700 music videos to promote their Video Music Awards this weekend. The artist with the most appearances in that lineup? It's Britney Spears. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. And from Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. yptc.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Creatine supplements aren't just for gym bros, apparently. Social media influencers promote benefits for your muscles and even your brain. So let's use our brains. What's the evidence show about the hype? Here's NPR's Maria Godoy.
On wellness TikTok, there's a lot of enthusiasm around creatine.
Raise your hand if you're taking creatine right now. It's the supplement of the year. And
like this video from influencer Bobby Parrish.
Creatine is legit. You talk about muscle strength, muscle power, muscle recovery. They even say that if you have a horrible night's sleep, if you do a 20-gram dose of this, it reverses the effect of it for that day.
So what is creatine? It's a compound made from three amino acids, says Jose Antonio. He teaches exercise and sports science at Nova Southeastern University in Florida.
Think of creatine as a source of energy.
It's stored in our muscles, and it can help provide energy to power through harder workouts. The body makes some creatine, and it also comes from food.
So beef, chicken, pork. But really, the food that has the most creatine is fish.
Research shows that increasing the amount of creatine stored in muscles can help to add lean muscle mass and improve athletic performance and speed recovery from workouts. You could get extra creatine through diet, but you'd have to eat a lot.
We're talking like 2 pounds of raw beef every day, and not many people are willing to do that.
So some people turn to creatine supplements. And when it comes to adding lean muscle mass, the evidence for creatine is pretty strong. It works. But Antonio says there's a caveat.
It's always coupled to exercise.
Studies have shown that when you combine creatine supplements with resistance training, adults can add around 2 to 3 pounds of lean muscle mass. For older people especially, since we tend to lose muscle mass as we age, it can be significant, says Abby Smith Ryan.
2 pounds of muscle for me as a middle-aged woman is actually really valuable versus a young person.
Smith Ryan is a professor of exercise and sports science at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She says studies have shown that middle-aged women who take creatine supplements and do resistance training can also maintain bone. And that's important because women tend to lose more bone mass than men with age.
I love that every woman is talking about creatine right now.
As for other potential benefits, like improving memory, helping your brain function better when you're sleep deprived, and maybe even boosting cognition, she says the research is interesting, but
I would say as a scientist, I would love more data.
Still, she says, if you want to try creatine supplements, go for it.
Creatine is not going to be the magic bullet, but I do think that it's a low-hanging fruit that has minimal side effects, that has potential benefit that could be helpful.
Generally, experts recommend taking 3 to 5 grams a day to see the muscle-building benefits of creatine supplements. Dr. Peter Cohen of Harvard Medical School studies supplement safety. He recommends buying supplements that contain creatine monohydrate, the most widely studied form, as the only ingredient.
When someone wants to use supplements, we need to know exactly what ingredient we're getting and exactly the precise dose.
So he says, make sure it's certified by a third-party certification program, like NSF Certified for Sport. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Support for NPR health coverage comes from AG1, maker of a drinkable multivitamin now available in three new flavors, tropical, berry, and citrus. Learn more at drinkag1.com.
This is NPR News.
Now's your chance to see one of the most acclaimed indie rock artists of the past 20 years at Grand Rapids Urfest, going on Saturday, September 6. In addition to Courtney Barnett, you'll get to see Alan Sparhawk, Jeremy Albino, and Margo Price. Don't let the bastards get you down. Don't sell your heart to no business man. You can get your tickets for Grand Rapids Riverfest at grandrapidsriverfest.com. You won't want to miss one of the biggest concert nights in northern Minnesota this year.
Morning edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadil. Catholics around the world were shaken by last week's shooting during a welcome back mass at the Annunciation Catholic Parish in Minneapolis. Pope Leo on Sunday denounced what he called a pandemic of arms. A few Catholic leaders in the U.S. demanded more protections against gun violence, including San Antonio Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Sierre.
We cannot just let these stories to continue piling up. And people are being killed, all ages and all over.
Aleja Hertzler-McCain of Religion News Service reports on how Catholic leaders have responded to the attack.
After the shooting, Catholic educators said they met for prayer in their communities. They also quickly got in contact with law enforcement. They're looking for any weaknesses in their safety plans. Karen Reben-Shook, an education official in the Archdiocese of Chicago, said schools will be practicing drills within their sanctuaries.
You don't think you need to practice that in the church, right? But now, will our schools be doing that? Absolutely, they will be doing that if they haven't already.
San Antonio Archbishop Gustavo Garcia Sierra was in Uvalde after the 2022 shooting at Robb Elementary School. He visited students in the hospital, consoled parents, and celebrated nightly masses. The Archbishop said there have been memorials for Uvalde, but no meaningful changes in public policy.
The changes have not happened in any way, not even in small ways.
After hearing of the shooting in Minnesota, Garcia Sierra repeated his call for tighter gun safety laws.
As we heard about this last one, again, all these arms in the hands of people that they should not have them, but that we, as a society, make those arms available.
In the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, Superintendent Paul Escala said spaces that traditionally may have seemed safe are no longer.
We've been very explicit with our schools and our churches that they need to now consider, if they hadn't before, the sanctuary as an area that could also be at risk.
But, Escala said, Catholics and others should not give in to fear.
If we have one another and if we look out for one another, we truly have that neighborly approach to living in society, we can do a better job of protecting each other from this kind of violence.
At the same time, Escala said, the Archdiocese of Los Angeles will be reviewing their school's safety plans. For NPR News, I'm Aleja Hertzler-McCain.
This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service.
More states are banning students from using their phones during school hours. Some individual schools as well. One of my kids has to zip the phone in a little bag during school hours. NPR's Sequoia Carrillo has the story.
This school year is the first one where every student in Texas public and charter schools will be without their phones during the school day. But Bridget Whaley, an associate professor of education at West Texas A&M University, has a hunch of how things will go.
A more equitable environment, a more engaging classroom for students.
She spent the last year surveying the rollout of a cell phone ban in a public high school in West Texas, focusing on how teachers felt about the program. They saw improved engagement and more conversation between students.
They were really happy to see that students were more willing to work with each other.
Student anxiety also plummeted, according to her research. The primary reason? Students weren't afraid of being filmed at any moment and embarrassing themselves.
They could relax in the classroom and participate and not be so anxious about what other students were doing.
The findings in West Texas align with the results from many of the states and districts that are heading back to school without phones. Students learn better in a phone-free environment. It's been a rare issue with bipartisan support, allowing a rapid adoption of policies across many states. That fast pace, Whaley says, can sometimes be a hazard to the policy's impact. While most teachers at the school she studied supported the ban,
there was one teacher that didn't enforce the policy well, and that seemed to cause difficulty for other teachers.
Every teacher had a little bit different policy on that.
That's Alex Stegner, a social studies and geography teacher in Portland, Oregon, talking about his district's cell phone ban. He says the different types of enforcement were normal at his school. Last year, each teacher at Lincoln High School got a lockbox to collect phones at the start of class.
Some teachers did not lock the boxes. Some teachers left the doors wide open, and some teachers, like me, locked them. I was just committed to kind of going all in with it, and I liked it.
He said last year was the first year in a decade he didn't spend class time chasing cell phones around the room. Now, as Lincoln goes into its second year with some kind of ban, things are changing a bit. This year, students' phones will be locked away for the entire day, not just class time. Stegner thinks it will be a learning curve, but not just for teachers and students.
I think some parents will struggle, but I do think that there seems to be this kind of collective understanding that we got to do something different.
Like a lot of schools, Lincoln High School will be distributing individual locked bags, known as Yonder pouches, to students this year. The same ones that were used in the district Whaley studied in Texas and for about 2 million students nationwide.
I heard stories last year about Yonder pouches, you know, cut open, destroyed, and there's a whole like logistical thing that comes with giving students these pouches and telling them like, okay, now that's your responsibility.
So teachers seem to like cell phone bans, but as for the kids,
you'll see a different response from students.
Rosalie Morales is in her second year overseeing Delaware's pilot program for a statewide cell phone ban. She surveyed teachers and students at the end of the first year to ask if the ban should continue. 83% of teachers said yes, while only 11% of students agreed.
It's annoying.
Zoe George, a student at Bard High School Early College in Manhattan, says no one asked her before New York State banned cell phones.
I wish that they would hear us out more.
She's worried about the implications for homework and schoolwork during free periods. She says her school doesn't have enough laptops for every student, so often students would use their phones. But also, it's just a nuisance.
It's not the worst because it's my last year, but at the same time, it's my last year.
Next year, she hopes to be at college, and she's looking forward to the freedom. Sequoia Carrillo, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is a minute before 7 o'clock. Good morning. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. You can join us at kaxe.org. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in a moment, a special edition of the Up North Report. At 9 o'clock this morning, Ham Radio, Cooking with Amy Phelan, an episode on the abundance of our gardens this time of year, preserving summer through memories, recipes, and